You're listening to WRFI, and this is the Made of Clay Report. This is a special edition of the Made of Clay Report called Facing Our Lives, where we take up an issue of concern and we address it with the two co-hosts and possibly guests, and we may have a guest later on. Today, Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay, we are your hosts, and I'm going to turn it over to Peaches to raise the topic or frame the topic in the way she wanted us to raise it. So, Peaches.
Yeah, so I think I would frame the topic using the words how our children are becoming more violent.
Okay.
And why? How and why our children are becoming more violent in society?
I immediately also, when you say that, I immediately also go to how there some are becoming more violent. And that is what we see. Some are becoming more withdrawn, which is another kind of violence. But I want to stay with it the way you framed it. And I don't think it assumed either direction.
That's exactly right. That's right.
Yeah.
And the withdrawal that, you know, as I was reading lots of material in this, the element of withdrawal, which is very true, when that child who wants to withdraw, but they have to be in school and they have to be around people and they have to be engaging in some way, the frustration level becomes very shallow and the acting out is usually violent.
Right.
And
right.
the same thing happens for children who may be quote unquote depressed and children who have anxieties. I think that part of this is it's all tagged together. Is why is it that in our society, any of these issues, anxiety, depression, if you want to trauma, whatever it is, are always acted out in severe violent behavior in younger and younger children? And there are causes for that that are studied. So and most of it we know, most of it is like the exposure.
Right. So what is it that you're seeing? Can you describe specific examples that we can jump into?
Yes. I am seeing children with lower and lower thresholds for frustration and for anxiety and for all of those things. But I see it as connected to the fact that we don't expect or teach children coping skills. What we do is we almost usher them into this way of thinking that says, if somebody is not doing what you want, then they're doing something wrong to you. And that's what I see going on in the classrooms. And so it lends to that concept, the justification to retaliate. And the retaliation is usually violence.
Right. So if this is what kinds of, okay, I want to ask a historic question. You may want to go more.
Great.
More. What kinds of containers did we have in the past that kind of that prevented or minimized the likelihood that we would take ourselves so seriously as to be the moral judge of everything going on around us?
You know, I think that I feel very strongly that in this day and age, we spend more time coddling people and their feelings. And I've mentioned this before, how feelings have become facts in the way we coddle people. And we coddle people so much more instead of helping them find their strength, because we all have strength.
Right.
Find the strengths within them and utilize them when things are not going their way. That's what I see happening in classrooms. Many classrooms. I've been in many classrooms up here. I taught for 40 years, and I see a progression. It was not like that even 10 years ago, or even 7 years when I was in New York. It's creeping into our way. I think it's a way of our believing that this is the way we deal with mental health issues by titrating all these emotions, and not looking at it this way. Well, if I placate that emotion, where does that lead? What domino effect does that have on the child themselves? And we do that even when there aren't mental issues, because we always assume they're mental health issues, even if they're not diagnosed.
Right. And the very language that you're using is causing me to wince And that's because when I was growing up, people would talk about coddling the emotions of children or the emotions of anyone. And it was used as a pejorative, but what was meant was just to take emotion seriously.
Right.
Because there was a time when people didn't take any emotional content as having any value. And the reactive backlash was you're coddling mm-hmm. them. But we take it so seriously now. What happened? Why do we take it so seriously now?
You know, so many things happen at the same exact time. I think that, you know, I think part of it is what you just said. We have a tendency in society to overreact to what we didn't like before.
Right.
Right? That's part of what we do. It's like if you spank your child, I will never discipline my child is part of the reaction to that, because I don't want them ever to feel bad, whether it's physically or emotionally or whatever. And I think that we've gone very far in that direction to make sure that children do never feel bad about anything. And feeling bad about things is part of the system of feeling remorseful or understanding other people's feelings or having compassion. Those feelings are tied together. When we don't feel for another person's pain, we're getting rid of compassion,
right?
Empathy.
Right.
And I think we've done that to a large degree.
Right. We also, if we help people understand their own internal meters, then they're going to be making choices of their own, which we may not control.
That's exactly right.
And that gets awkward.
And we do very little of that. Pete, this old concept of, like, what do they call them? Hovering parents, helicopter parents, right? That concept of helicopter parents has bought into this whole thing of, like, I have to stand over my child at every minute and make sure whatever they're feeling, I actually negotiate for them. They don't negotiate it. I don't teach them how to negotiate it, but I'm going to negotiate it for them. Great. But when your child is in school and you're not there, who's helping them negotiate their feelings?
Right, right, right. I also want to point out that I don't know the exact numbers, but I think the square footage of housing that a family occupies, particularly middle-class families, has doubled in the last 50 or 60 years. Okay. And kids never have to share a room. And there may only be one child. So the negotiation that is learned as you have more devices to be entertained upon by yourself, you have less and less incentive to learn a skill to deal with another person.
That's right. And that's one way of being socialized, because that's the other thing that came up in articles, that children are not socialized in the way that they used to be socialized. Even something as simple as playing out on the streets with other kids,
right,
as opposed to sitting on video games.
Right, right, right. And the point being, it's not just not in the way that they used to be socialized.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's no notion that there's a community or a society that of people to whom they are accountable and for whom they show up.
That is exactly right. Because it used to be that, I see this overprotectiveness that has gone crazy. Of course, my mother protected me when I was a child. But if she knew I was wrong, she did not.
Right.
She did not. She might talk to the person or talk to the teacher or let another parent discipline me, quite frankly.
Right.
Where in these cases, in these days, no one has, if you try to discipline a child in a certain kind of way, lawsuits are coming. And that's what a lot of teachers are afraid of. If you correct a child, parents get angry because you have no right to talk to their children. So the child no longer belongs, quote unquote, to the community. The child is like a little piece of property that you own and you regulate and you dictate what goes on and what does not go on to that property. That's the way I see it.
Right, right. So to play with your metaphor, as a piece of property subject to the whims and the control of others, then one never really has to cultivate a sense of personal agency, unless you do it as an act of complete rebellion or lack of acceptance of the status quo.
In which case, it becomes just a negative
as opposed to a creative.
That is
positive.
Exactly. That's right. That's what I was going to say. That's right. Because that reactionary response is not usually thought out. It's just like, oh, I'm getting away from that thing, but I didn't really put anything else in place to go to.
And in fact, I didn't even think through the consequences of what the next step is.
Right.
I remember once when I did something like that, I took off on my bicycle and I was going to run away from home, and I got far enough away from home that my shoelace caught in my bicycle gear and wound itself around. So I could neither ride forward, nor could I go any further. So I had to push myself with one foot at a time until I went back home and got the shoelace cut. Anyway, that silliness was, you know, and you've got to stay at some point and figure it out. I think back in the day, and I think if your mom perceived that the consequences that you were suffering because you did something wrong or done something inappropriate and somebody else disciplined you, it wouldn't be like you would be cut loose to them, but they would be watching. So if things got out of hand, they could step in, but not to question the authority of the other person disciplining you, to question the degree.
That is exactly it. Absolutely. You know, the punishment has to fit the crime. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And an interesting point that you made secondary to what I was thinking is that there's this absolute lack of trust for any authority.
Right.
We're not taught to question authority if it feels wrong. We question authority even if it's right.
Well,
often. And we look at things as being a violation of our individuality to a proportion that is really not reasonable.
Right. And I think this is, we're just going to head into something really important, but I think we should take, is there music that you have that you would like very much for us to play at this point?
I do. The first thing that song that came to mind was Teach Your Children, right?
Okay, here we go.
Nash and Young.
Are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. Your elders grew high, and so please help them with your youth. They seek the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. Thank you.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, and we are looking at the epidemic of violence and individualism on the part of our youth and how we might actually address that. Peaches, where you pointed out there's no trust. And when I hear that word, that my ears just kind of point up real like a like a trained animal. And trust has come to mean if I can predict that you're going to agree with me, I'm going to agree with you, then I can trust you. Because we're going to have a set of behaviors that we're going to orchestrate because we're on the same team.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to trust you if we don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not trust.
Right. That is true. In some circumstances, like with a child, like when we're talking about, like, we want to make sure that the crime is fitting the punishment, that your reaction is right. Then there is that element of, like, we have to agree about something.
So right. Or
that, yeah.
But I guess when I was using the example, I was thinking we don't have to agree about it. The two adults in the space can have a disagreement, but they actually understand that they cannot completely block the other one from doing something that doesn't fit their point of view, but it doesn't completely annihilate their point of view either.
Okay.
It's not in direct opposite. A lot of what we experience, we wouldn't endorse, but we also wouldn't condemn.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
You know, and so trust allows us to, we can figure this out.
Yes.
We can see where this goes. And then we can decide where we're going to step in or not step in. And that's the quality. Most people confuse trust with the prediction of an outcome. And what I'm trying to say, trust is the prediction that I will be able to step in a way that will be useful and helpful and true. And that I can do that. I trust myself to do that, regardless of what happens.
Yes.
It's not a prediction at all, except it is a kind of confidence. And, you know, the word faith, which is in the middle of confidence, is hope and trust. And that trust piece is having a sense that I either have the skills or I'll learn them in the moment.
Okay.
To deal with it.
I completely get it. When I think sometimes of, if I think back on a situation which, when I adopted Jamel, I had no plan on having children. And then Mel came to my life at 9 years old, a whole different ball of wax, right? And the first time I remember someone cheating him in a grocery store out of money, it brought something out of me that I never needed at any other point.
Right, right.
And so part of it was based on the fact that I actually knew the man in the store, and I already knew, I could already predict his behavior because I knew that he was that kind of person in that way.
Sure.
And so I responded to it by just going down and protecting Jamel and getting his money, the accurate amount of money back for him. So I think that there are nuances to trusting people.
Right, right. Eyes wide open.
Yes.
And this is what I didn't say before is that trust is with your eyes wide open.
So you
know that people will be who they are.
100%.
We trust people to be who they are, not who they are not.
That's right.
And so if you know this is a problematic person, you're turning your beloved into their control, and you just realize that's life.
That's right. That is right.
And you go with the risk, but you don't go so far away that they're completely alone.
That abandons the child.
Yes.
That's exactly right. Like, I didn't say, oh, don't go down to that store because I know that guy is shady, because I don't want to teach him that either. Because he may have a different kind of way of being with that person. You never know. But I wanted him to, of course, have the experience of going to the store and getting his change and, you know, the things that you try to teach children in life. And I don't try to, unless I know somebody's exactly dangerous, I don't try to influence the way somebody is trusted necessarily. But I keep a watchful eye, like you said.
Right.
Absolutely watchful eye.
And if you're really good at it, you don't front load the prejudices of your child.
Absolutely not.
You let them discover how the world reacts to them and how they need to react to the world. But it's a step. It's a process of walking into the water.
That's exactly right.
Ankle deep, knee deep, but not being thrown into the deep end.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And some of the conversations that come out of allowing children to have that experience are amazing.
Right.
To listen to a child's perspective on someone is always fascinating to me, you know, because sometimes they're really right on, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're not, you know, but I want to hear it, you know, and it's good to sit down and help them negotiate whatever it is they're feeling.
Right. And if you didn't tell them what to anticipate, then you're not mm-hmm. going to be getting a story that they will have crafted to fit your expectations.
That is exactly right.
You will begin to see them as the censors of their own lives and the people who will choose how to live their own lives.
Yes, yes, yes. You know, a general things you teach them, like I would always teach Mel, you know, people like houses, right? Mm-hmm. They can look completely beautiful on the outside, but you have no idea what's on the inside. That's the kind of thing I would say.
Yeah.
But not like, don't trust that guy and don't trust that guy. I mean, I you can do that and that's reasonable, but I haven't met people that had to do that about, you know what I mean?
Right. Or been in, yeah. And yeah.
So I think that, you know, a lot of what's going on, I mean, there's so many things, right? Nothing ever happens for one reason. So there's so many things contributing to this violence in children. And part of it is exactly the kind of thing we were just discussing, that we don't allow our children to figure things out. Mm-hmm. They can come to us for advice or for comfort or whatever, but to try to at least start figuring it out themselves, because that's what they have to do in the world anyway, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, right.
And it also teaches them to not distrust everyone. To go through life distrusting everyone is a terrible way to exist. And you will lose out on so many things because you just always look at people with like either a critical eye or an eye of like, oh, I know you're a bad guy. So you don't want to teach children that by saying, don't trust this person, don't trust that person, or by telling them the world is not a place that you can trust. But you do it in very subtle and soft ways that kind of bridge them across those divides to understanding who people are and what certain behavior represents. That's the other thing. It's like when you tell a child, if somebody touches you in a certain way, that behavior represents something.
Right.
You know, so teach them what behaviors represent. You know?
Right. The way I listen is I listen for what's being said, and then I listen for the opposite of what's not being said. And you just, you don't want to tell your children not to trust or model that too much for them. But we live in a time, I don't think Americans would accept this language, but we have succumbed, I think, across the political spectrum to a sort of fundamentalism. And that fundamentalism is that we think we can define who the good folks are.
Mm-hmm.
And we think we can define who the bad folks are. And you just need to get with the program.
Yes, yes.
And that means that we've ceased to really receive people as the complicated beings they are, because we've already put a label on them as acceptable or unacceptable. It also takes away the chance for a child or an immigrant to kind of discover who they can trust and how they can trust and who they might want to be cautious about. And in their discovery, we may see things we overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Like my kids saw an issue with a music teacher in school that I completely didn't get, but all the kids in the school were onto it. And those who were talking to their parents were onto it. And, you know, that's how I learned about it, because I was blind.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that the word, you know, we eliminate, or in some ways, we try to eliminate the complexities of human beings. And it's like saying that, it reminds me, and this came up last night when I was in a workshop, to say that if I said that, oh, somebody was racist against me, and that person goes, oh, but they're so nice. Right? I mean, those two things don't even make sense together. A nice person can be anything, you know,
right.
I mean, can exhibit any kind of behavior. That's not the, you know, the ground markings for how a person is not racist is being nice. I mean, we know that through history, when we look at people who are serial killers and they're lovely people doing things in the community, it's not about that. And so what we do is we behave as if people are not complex animals with
right.
all different sides. Now that also begs into the element of like trust and distrust. My attitude is like, you're in school. I'm trusting that they're going to take care of you. That's my attitude.
Right.
If something comes up, I'll deal with it as it comes up. But I'm not sitting at home thinking, oh my God, what are they doing to my kid?
Right. But you also trust your kid to be able to either handle it in the moment, bring it home to you, or find somebody else there to help them.
That's right.
That's part of trust.
If
you taught
them that.
If you taught them that.
That's right. And sometimes people don't teach them that. They really don't.
That's right.
They don't say, if I say to my grandsons who act out, if somebody is bothering you, go get a grown-up. That's what the grown-ups are there for. I don't say, well, you can't trust some of them, so don't go. I go get a grown-up. That's what they're there for. They're
right.
there to help you, right?
Right.
So that's a lesson that I'm teaching him.
Right. And my guess is that when you say go get a grown-up, they're already thinking, well, who do I feel comfortable with?
That's exactly right.
And you don't have to prime the pump because they're already going there.
No.
Yeah.
And they will come back to me and say, I did go to a grown-up and they didn't help me. And so then the next step has to be taken.
Right, but you can also grieve the fact that that person didn't do what would have been helpful.
Yeah.
And that they can still ask. That person isn't the be-all and end-all of the world.
That's exactly right. And all of this is about really conversations with your children and not those assumptions that the person did something wrong. Or even this matter. Children, they're children. They translate things very differently than adults often. So some child could come home and say, I remember, I've had this experience many times. The teacher was really, really mean to me. And if I were a certain kind of parent, I might go, I can't believe that teacher treated you that way. I'm going to go in there and save the day.
Right.
Or I can say, tell me what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I get stories like, they told me to sit in my seat. Right?
Right. No, yeah, right.
I mean,
they thwarted what you wanted to do, and so they were mean.
So, but I find that parents are not rational about those things anymore.
Right. Right. But the child, I mean, my children would talk about a teacher coming in the classroom who was already agitated and snapping at a student. Now, that isn't being mean to the student, but that's being, I mean, and children can pick up that difference.
Oh, yeah.
And know what that means if you talk it through with them.
That is exactly right. That is it.
And, you know, the one teacher was going through a very messy divorce when one of my children was in her classroom. And in some ways, it was just part, it was there, it was a tone. But everybody knew that they could be kind. And they could call, they had kind of a way of, you know, calling out to kind of, let's do something fun. Let's sing for a while.
Okay,
let's do something else.
Yeah. Oh, good. Very fantastic. That is great.
And so the person could continue her life and the kids could take responsibility for the culture of the classroom.
Yes. Yes.
People will push back on me, but the kids are as responsible for the culture of the classroom as the teacher.
Yes.
The teacher makes the first motion.
That's right.
And sets that initial tone.
That's right.
But beyond that, it's a collaborative effort.
Yes.
Whether you're in kindergarten or sixth grade or a senior in high school.
Yes. And you reinforce it in all the things you do. Like someone comes in a classroom, they're having, like you said, having a messy divorce or whatever it is. They know they're just not feeling up to par. They don't necessarily have to tell the children about the divorce, but if you said to a child, I'm not feeling well, we're going to do something else today so we can take a little bit of a break. That helps children, that gives them language.
Right.
As opposed to walking in the door and just acting out crazily or hitting somebody else or whatever. And I don't think we do that very well at all.
Right. Right. I do think kids can handle the fact that a person is having a divorce who happens to be their teacher, because the kids have gone through that themselves.
Yes, and I would attribute it to the age that the child is.
Yes. Yeah.
How you know, if you know how they were coping with that divorce right. that went on in their family, right. and all of those things have to be brought into the picture.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. One of my children's teachers lost a child in a terrible accident that should not have happened, but it did. And that was nothing that could be hidden.
No.
And so the class had to had to kind of live in that awareness, not with too much awareness.
No.
But with clear awareness.
Yeah.
I want to cut to music again, and then I want to talk about this, the issue of politeness. And you talked about, you know, prejudice versus politeness. I want to come back at that in a slightly different way.
Okay.
So what do you have something to play now, or shall I go find something?
Yeah. I Am a Child. I think it's a Neil Young.
That's it. No, that is Jackson Browne from
Saturday. Yes, thank you. That is Jackson Browne. How did I forget? God forgive me.
I
I'm going to get this quote wrong. I want you, the listeners, to know that I get things wrong, but it's going to be close enough, and the intent is exactly where I want to go with it. Machiavelli is reported to have written or said that it does not matter whether or not you are virtuous. It matters only that you appear to be so. Mm-hmm. And we live in a culture where that appear to be so is the normative way we are in terms of the broader culture. Now, within particular groups or families, that's clearly not going to work. But that is the default mode in public schools, in workplaces. It's just, you know, it's a default. So the people who appear most to be polite, for those who do not know what's really going on inside or around that person, they're going to be fooled. Mm-hmm. And they're going to feel really kind and generous toward that person. But to a person who is in the know, whose life is made less, because while all the while they're smiling and being publicly kind, they're withholding resources or denying needs or condemning or judging or whatever. And that person is going to develop an intense hatred of politeness.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are in a time where politeness and the way you appear in social media and your work stuff and professionalism, the way you appear counts for everything, but at the same time, we don't trust it.
Right.
Nor should we. No, and at really. root, our problem with authority is that we don't trust these representations, these formal politenesses, and we do not want to let anything be done to us that we do not consent to, because we have been sold a bill of goods on professionalism and politeness. That doesn't mean there's not such a thing as really excellent practice.
Right.
But it's wearing the garb to look virtuous without really having virtue in heart, where you can sometimes do the thing that breaks the rules, but it is the thing that is required to be good and true.
That's exactly right. Or to be angry or to be upset.
Right.
Like
right.
The problem with this niceness. And this is, I have to say that this intensity of this experience with niceness only happened when I came up here. Because in New York City, there's so many people, it doesn't feel, you meet people who are superficially nice. That is true. You'll meet them anywhere. But it doesn't become like a concentration because it's so spread out. So you meet people like who are just, they don't care if they seem nice. So, you know, you meet a large range of people who span the gamut of whatever it is to mean, whatever it is that means nice to them. Up here seems so much more concentrated that niceness seems to be like the soup of the day. And so often I feel like I'm not having a real conversation with people. And because what they've done was they have distilled niceness down to excluding speaking strongly, excluding being angry, excluding responding in objection to what somebody says, that if you do those things, you're not nice anymore.
Right, right.
And that's a problem. That's a serious problem.
Right, right. And so you have a case, and I mean a legalistic kind of case against the people. The prophet that is Peaches Gillette has an issue with this place called Ithaca in Tompkins County. And I do too, and it's the same sort of issue. And I think it would bear some time for us to spend with it. What we often don't realize here, and I think we could cut directly to address the issue, and I want you to cut directly to it. I'm going to give what could be construed as rationalization or explanation or indulging feelings or or whatever. I don't mean it to be any of those things, except I mean it to be an act of empathy for a place that has suffered. This part of upstate New York was subject to intense revivalism in the 19th century, and people opened themselves up and submitted to each other and were cruelly abused in that process. And we're more wary of that now. You know, Cornell got founded in kind of reaction to that stuff. But this place was a company town where most employment was managed by four or five or six large manufacturing concerns up until World War II. And then Cornell took off and it began to equal the manufacturing. But there were still more jobs in manufacturing than in higher education up until 1978, when manufacturing began to collapse. And over the course of maybe 6 or 8 years, 2/3 or 3/4 of the jobs in manufacturing were lost. And Cornell bulked up with all sorts of institutes and special programs and took on people. And that was part of when universities became more entertainment centers with health fitness centers, as well as every imaginable program to support, to raise money, to do research on whatever, as they were trying to bring in outside funding. Cornell is a feudal structure. Manufacturing in those days, even though there were unions, they were feudal structures.
Okay.
And people were extremely subject to whether or not they could get along or had any clout to fight back. And it's a company town, but the company has changed, but the dynamics haven't really changed. And then there were lots of people who came in the 60s and stayed because the housing was pretty decrepit. It was cheap. It was interesting. And a lot of the locals didn't want anything to do with those protesters because they were ready to put them in pins and haul them off to jail, which didn't happen, but they were prepared to do it in 1969. And it became just a whole lot easier to have polite conversation, both at work and in the wider community. Mm-hmm. And when I was an undergraduate in the late 1970s, my professor said to me, and he was trying to be kind, he was trying to give me a heads up. When people ask you what you think, they don't really want to know. Mm-hmm. And I came from a culture where if you bothered to ask somebody what they thought, if you didn't care, you wouldn't ask. Mm-hmm. And yet here you would ask, but you wouldn't care or listen to the response, which is really confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be part of what you're picking up on it two generations later, when people are, the presumption is you lead with a kind of safeness.
Mm-hmm.
And you keep the language and the rhetoric safe within the particular community that you think you're with.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say that it has at times and does at times feels very cult-like to me. That I'm supposed to be kind of drawn into this way of being that has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a nice person, but I don't exclude all the other parts of myself that somebody may not feel. It's not even realistic. They may not feel as nice because I got very adamant about something I was saying when we were having a harder discussion. And so there's an emptiness about the kind of niceness. And not in all people. I mean, there are people just literally, they're just nice people. There's nothing else to say. But there's an emptiness in some of the niceness that blocks any in-depth or working conversation mm-hmm. to resolve issues.
Right.
Because everybody's stepping back into being nice and they don't want to have that confrontation and they don't want to do this. And that's not a good place to be. It's not a good place to be because what happens is that the person, not necessarily me, but the person that you're showing this kind of empty niceness to, who's trying to get deeper into a conversation, ends up just being frustrated and maybe not even like you anymore when you're trying to present yourself as the nicest person in the world and you're not even being successful is what you're trying to do because you're diminishing the deeper thoughts that other people are trying to share with you. And that, to me, is a huge problem. And it's also part of the problem with our children. When you go into classrooms, they have all these great signs about being nice and being this and do this and we're number one in this. But the niceness becomes superficial.
Right.
There's no deeper conversation about what does that really mean? And is that the word we actually want to use?
I don't quite know how to respond because you hit so many pieces of experience. If you can hear my story and my situation and not feel like you have to take responsibility for it, but show that you actually heard it, that you may disagree, that you may see it differently, but you at least we're standing next to each other and looking into my experience and looking into your experience, because that's permissible.
Mm-hmm.
Most in polite conversation, anything going on behind the eyeballs or under the skin is not allowed to be explored.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really dangerous.
It is. And it doesn't allow, I mean, I am who I am. You know, I am deliberately a very polite person, but I'm not superficial about it. But I'm also deliberately an honest person.
Right, right. And you said maybe polite isn't the right word. And I do think that polite is not the right word, even for describing
nice,
who
not,
you
that
are.
Word, nice,
or nice, nice. I don't
I get
think
sick
nice,
of that word.
I don't think, I don't think that nice, polite, or kind
mm-hmm.
are good okay, words yeah. for this.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know any better words. So
right, exactly.
To me, the term play nice or be kind
yeah.
is an invitation to superficiality.
Yeah, or it can be.
It has been so often used in that way that I have a hard time dislodging it from those associations.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's an improvement over the command to be polite. It doesn't matter what you feel, you just be polite. Right. There's at least some on be nice or be kind. There's some acknowledgement that there's some potentially some internal motivation.
Yeah. And you know, there are grades of everything. Look, I could be polite and still tell somebody I don't agree with them, because mm-hmm. polite has all these grades to it. Or,
right.
or I don't really like the word nice, but let's just say polite, using the right. manners that are of our culture. Let's say polite, but I don't have to be impolite to be honest. And I think that that's what the connection is, that if you're honest about something, then you're not being polite. If I say to somebody, I don't like what you said to me, or not better than that, it has to be a critique. The way you treated that waitress was awful.
Right.
I don't find that impolite.
No, but you said it. Matter of fact, you defined it. You didn't, you kept it very clean in terms of the assessment.
Yeah, and when I mean, and this is not just here, we've gotten to this point where anything that you say to anyone that sounds even slightly like a criticism just breaks them down
right.
or shoots them into violence.
Right.
And that's what we're doing to our children. Our children have their own agency, but they do what we do. There were studies and you know, people push back on these kind of studies that children witness by the time they're in elementary school 8,000 different forms of terrible violence through media, mainly. Mm. Some kids witness it in their lives. They imitate it.
Right.
And it increases as they get old, of course, because they could be more exposed and they're on their own and whatever. And the violence becomes sexual and hateful and all sorts of things that our children are acting out in a world that continuously tells us that we are powerless. Children find power in violence. It's not like an adult that I might find power in, like, oh, doing great services for people that makes me feel like, okay, uplifted and maybe a little more powerful, like I have some control over something. Most children don't have, your children don't go to the bar and have a drink when they're stressed out. What they're going to do is most of the time act out. And when they're seeing it approved and affirmed by the culture around them, they are more likely to do it.
Right.
And they get desensitized as they get older.
Right, right, right. And I guess where I'm hearing and mostly in accord with what you're saying, but I'm resisting what mm-hmm. you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And the resistance has to do with, in my particular household growing up, people participated in multiple conversations at the same time. They finished each other's sentences. They had an understanding of perspectives and points of view very quickly. So they would be, you know, and you would step in if you were misunderstood. But yeah. you know, the people, we knew each other well enough that it. But to be observed from the outside, it would have been perceived as completely raucous, not polite, and perhaps borderline abusive, because there's a raw emotionality to it. Because people who are in a direct relation, their emotions are not hidden.
Yes.
They're also not abused.
Yes.
And so that kind of subtlety, I think is what the kids don't go straight from. They don't go straight to violence if they have other intermediate ways of being physical and being emotional that will be noticed.
That's right.
And taken seriously and walked further up or further down, depending upon what's mm-hmm. happening and what's appropriate for both the child or the incident they're responding to or the other person or mm-hmm. or whatever. We don't seem to track very well with each other. We don't seem to listen or look at each other or read body language or tone or know how to play with it. I remember being so scared about raising my voice, where raising one's voice was an accepted part of communication where I come from. But here it's like, you know, you raise your voice and you're a lunatic.
No, it's true. You're so on the mark. I remember saying to, and you know, I grew up in a world that we goofed around. Let me just call it that.
Sure.
And it wasn't about being polite. We just goofed around, and you knew the person. You know how to take it. You know how to come back on it. And nobody was hurt or wounded or traumatized or whatever it is that the language we use. And I remember up here, I said to the boys, my grandsons, I said, come over here. I'm going to fit my hand around your neck just in case I need to do something. And the person who I was with was utterly floored. I mean, they thought, my God, how could you be so abusive? It was unbelievable to me. And I'm thinking, my God, that's the way we grew up. Nobody cared.
Right.
Nobody
right.
was wounded.
And it was kind of playing with power.
It was playful.
It was playful, but it was playful with power and physicality both.
And the boys know it because yeah. they grew up with me.
Yeah, but also I think yeah, and stereotypically boys know it. But I think yeah, and it's a kind of physical play, which if you don't make it violent, it's not inherently violent.
That's right.
I mean, it might fit the literal definition of a description of a violent act.
Absolutely.
But that's because there is no understanding.
That's exactly right. And also the idea that someone doesn't I'm speaking to my grandchildren. I'm going to say that. They're my grandchildren. We have a life that we've molded together.
Right.
You see that they're actually laughing when I say that, and yet that means nothing in your head at all.
Right.
That's what's crazy, you know? Or the idea that, oh, maybe like if I saw somebody die, like, oh, maybe that's the way they play with one another. You know, you tease one another, you call people names, or some people play like jokes, like putting sleeping people's hands in warm water. People do different things
right.
as part of their personal culture, their family culture.
Right. And they can have kind and unkind outcomes. And sometimes the unkind ones were intended and they're perfectly fine because they were part of a series of unfortunate events, let's say.
Yes, yes. You know, and you go back and you're fine together and you love each other to death and you do whatever it is. And that's all that should really matter.
Right.
I'm sure there are things that could make me balk. I mean, if they were, you know, I mean, anything could be out of line. That is the truth.
Right.
But we are so, I find that we have created such an emotionally delicate culture of people.
Right.
That it's hard to even address. I said to somebody I worked for one time that I would love to have a conversation, a hard conversation with somebody who doesn't feel like they need to cry.
Right.
Can't have one little snag in a conversation without you feeling emotionally broken down. There's something very disturbing to me about that. Now, there are conversations that do that. There's no question about it. And of course, I have to consider who I'm talking to because some people are emotionally more delicate. That is true. But that's really not what I'm talking about.
Right.
I'm talking about it is just kind of like the immediate reaction to shut down the conversation.
Right. The tears are this is, in clinical chaplaincy training, you're taught to interpret what are the meaning of tears, because tears have hundreds of different meanings. And are the tears meant to say, I'm not going there? Are the tears meant to say, you hurt me and I'm going to make you pay? Because this has ended and I'm in tears and you're obviously the perpetrator.
Oh, yes. I find it often. Go ahead. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to. I want to go on this topic longer, but I think we should take a break for music. And I don't know what to play next. Do you have something in your.
You know, it's funny that I didn't know this about the song Hey Jude.
Right.
Was written for. Is it Lennon who wrote that song?
I don't remember.
The Beatles. It was written for somebody's son, that song.
Right.
The young son. So Hey Jude is a great song.
Right.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let it can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better. Refrain, don't carry
This is the Made of Clay Report, and Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts. We are exploring why we are so quick to go to violence or the judgment of bad behavior, rather than be able to really engage or work things through with each other. And why aren't we teaching our children how to do that? And if you have comments on this show, you can call 607-319-5445 extension 6 and leave them there, and they will get to both of us. Or you can go to Made of Clay to info, send an email to info@madeofclay.org, and we will get it. Again, area code 607-319-5445 extension 6, or email info@madeofclay.org. So Peaches, what I was thinking, and I watched the civil rights, kind of the latter years of the civil rights movement and the beginning of the Black Power movement and the women's movement and the gay movement from a small rural community in Northwest Missouri. And I found the rhetoric of rights stifling, and I found the rhetoric of power liberating. Because within the rhetoric of power, there is something that you should do, and there is something that you need to learn to use it well, as opposed to poorly, and as opposed to the kind of the rhetoric of rights, which is like almost you, there's a right to this and a right to that, and if this happens, then that happens, which all becomes like a form of mental calculus or emotional calculus, and it just didn't feel right to me. And that's the feeling I've had for a long time. What I sense happened here in Ithaca, which so much of the culture turns here, the shifting to being an academic, international place where people are extremely cautious, coincides with the rise of the rights language and the rise of the rights kinds of movements. And I feel like we live in a culture where everyone is a fundamentalist with their checklist of their favorite rights, whether it's civil rights or gun rights, but it's a checklist, and they are judging people on that basis and not really interacting with them about the way they seek to live the lives they value and how they either help each other or check each other when things are out of control.
That's right.
And I think that is a negative legacy of the various rights movements, but we haven't faced it. And I don't mean, I'm not anti anybody,
right?
But what I am is pro personal agency and a sense of the structures, the processes where we engage each other.
Yes.
All this is by way of saying, how do you imagine that we would interact with each other or with our children in a way that would produce a different sort of outcome than what we're seeing with people who are quick to become too volatile or just dismiss each other or wall each other off? How would you suggest that we address this?
Yeah. And it's very tricky because, you know, the tides are against parents who are trying to keep their children away from that kind of violent reaction to things or hitting people, pulling their hair, whatever it is you want to call it, that the world that they are exposed to, and you can't lock your child away from the world,
right?
Is about violence. It really is. It is predominantly about violence. They show violence in schools. I mean, I had reports back from my grandsons that they watched a movie where somebody killed themselves. Why? So our schools are perpetuating it. Home is definitely perpetuating it through video games and things like that. So you're operating against a forceful current.
Right.
In my world, the way I would address it is about just talking and modeling, and even explaining my emotional response to certain things so that I can have language for my emotions. I can tease them out and really evaluate them or assess them. And that I understand that I could actually use those emotions to diffuse a situation.
Right.
Like I remember I was in a car with my niece, she was 14 maybe, and somebody was screaming at me for going too slowly, which I absolutely do, and cursing, and she goes, I don't understand why you didn't argue with them. Like, this is in her head, that the reaction should have been my screaming back at that person out of the car.
You should have defended your right.
That is exactly right. I'm just not that kind of person. Right. I can't tell you. It's just, I'm not I don't raise my voice often. I'm not that kind of person. But what really struck me more than that was that that's what she thinks needs to be the reaction. And that is not a far step from stepping out of a car and getting into a fist fight.
Right. Right.
So they already see that violence, whether it's in your language or your voice, and the other kind of violence that's already perpetuated in our society, are linked together. And if you can't get somebody to agree or listen or concede, then maybe you just have to do something more than that, which is what happens in the classrooms. What happens in the classroom is somebody takes somebody's seat and somebody says, that's my seat, and it may have been. And the kid goes, I'm not getting up. So the next step is to hurt them.
Right.
There's nothing in between that. So we have to teach our children a long list of responses that are in between that, including just letting it go.
Right.
It has to be one of the responses.
Right, right. So I want to play with your driving example, because sometimes I drive fast, sometimes I drive slow. But I also have a sense that if somebody is behind me in a hurry, I can either pull over or I can speed up.
Yep.
If I'm going to insist on holding that speed, then I'm going to need to know that there's a space ahead where there's passing possible, because my driving on the road also includes this other person's driving.
No question about that.
And so it becomes more of a team sport.
Yes.
As opposed to an individual right.
That's right. Now, I completely agree with you. I have sped up. Mm-hmm. I've actually slowed down so that people could pass me.
Pass you. That's another point. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Than I am. And I've pulled over many, many times for people, because you just don't play like that on the road. You just don't do that.
Yeah.
But what happens is at times, if, and I don't know if it happens up here, I haven't had the experience. In New York is more of it. I'm sitting at a green light, a red light. It turns green in 1 second, and the person's cursing at me out the window.
Right, right.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
it's irrational.
Right. No. It's a hair trigger reaction.
Oh my God! Yes.
and so I guess. Okay, so here comes. When you're dealing with visceral responses, those things change on the order of months, years, and decades. So when people's visceral responses are to be that reactive and judgmental, it's going to take a long process.
Yeah.
And for me to react to that means that I will probably put them deeper into a commitment to that reactivity, because mm-hmm. my reaction reinforces them.
Mm-hmm.
But not reacting, there needs to be something, an alternative,
mm-hmm.
which is just to say, I mean, it could be just, you know, I hope you have a better day.
Oh, totally.
With complete genuine and not sarcastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, even if I knew the person was out of line.
Right. Right, right. I didn't mean to hurt your day, explain how life's thumb has been so hard on you that you know that it's crushed whatever of your generosity, you know. But
I can feel for people. I mean, most of the time I'm like, I'm sorry. I'll be like, I'll wave and say, I got it, I get it, I'm going too slowly, whatever it is. I just my point is that my next step is never confrontation. It is never the first.
Right. Right. Well, and so the result of a lot of individualism, whether it's individualism of the right or the left, is that we don't think about how our actions work together.
Yes.
And we have to dance with people, whether we like them or not.
Yes.
Because they are who are in our environment. And we may need to learn how to forcibly contain them, but usually you figure that out after you've danced a little while.
Yeah, and absolutely, without a question. Because like I said, it doesn't matter. If I know the person is absolutely wrong and out of line, I still don't react that way. I react in a way that kind of like keeps things like, let them do what they need to do, whatever if maybe they're in a hurry, I have no idea what's happening with them. They need to get ahead of me. That's perfectly fine.
Right.
If they're tailgating me for miles, I'm running at the speed limit, a little over the speed limit. They're tailgating me. Obviously, they want to go much faster than that.
Right.
I will pull over. So it has nothing to do with whether that person is right or wrong in my view. It has to do with the fact that I am not going to step into, I don't believe in war being the first result.
Right. But it also means that you are sharing the road with a person who doesn't, quote, follow the rules.
Yeah.
And yet most of life isn't about following the rules. It's about being sensitive to what we each need or don't or can let go of.
Yes, yes, yes. And we could teach our children that. I've always said to my kids, I remember someone was really mean to Jamel when he was a little kid. And he asked me why they were mean. And, you know, and I said, I don't know, you know, but sometimes you just have to give people a break. We don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that. And we don't do that with our children. We want to seek retribution. And our children know that. And so they seek retribution in the way that children know how to do that.
Right.
And what they've been taught through society. And most of it's through violence. Now, the extreme of that is the idea, and this always blows my mind with adults or children, is what is it that makes people, like you watch somebody kicking somebody to death, they're broken, they're crying, they're bleeding, and nothing says stop. Okay,
right.
Stop. Stop now. That's what's happening to our children.
Right,
they don't stop.
Right. Having intervened in violence in emergency rooms in the hospital or on the street or whatever, yelling stop, if the people are completely out of control, stop can work.
Yes.
If the people are feeling willfully violent, then it usually is more effective to frame the intervention as a question. Is killing this person going to get what you want? Or, you know, where they it's the question is big enough that they can, that it has substance, but it's small enough that they can't deny that they heard it. And the minute that happens, then they get the rhythm of their abuse has to change.
Okay.
And almost always it stops, has been my experience. When you hit a person who is really enraged, but still to some extent in control, with a question that stops them in their tracks, it slows things down and creates a window. If you tell them to stop, it may just enrage them further.
Right, that may be true.
Yeah.
But what I was focusing on is what is it inside of them? What has just been pushed out of their head that doesn't make them tell themselves to stop?
To stop, yes. And my guess is that they have neither spoken to nor been listened to much at all. Because they're on a script that's just their own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually, sometimes I think, I remember the story, you probably remember it. There was a story about two fathers. I think one was a coach, I don't know, soccer or something. They got into an argument, of course, because that's just going to happen. And one of the coach father, they were in the bathroom, he slammed this guy's head against the floor several times and killed him.
Wow.
And killed him. I can't even process this. And I, in my first thought, was like, do they think this is television? That you could just smash people around and throw them off a wall and they're going to be okay? What is going on in your head? That I'm sure that, like, if you asked that man, he wouldn't say, yeah, I want to be a murderer at some point in my life. I'm sure that wasn't his cause,
right?
And the perspective of the, I'm sorry, it's a soccer game. That even that, you couldn't even put that in perspective.
Right. And it probably happened when there were no witnesses.
Oh,
because
yes.
that kind of out of control behavior can be stopped by simply saying stop, because you break the moment, you can break the moment. But also if you
could bull rush somebody and break the moment.
That's exactly right. But sometimes, I drove up on an accident where one driver had struck the car of the other driver, and one of the drivers had a 3 or 4 year old kid in the back seat where the car made contact. The driver with the child jumped out and started to attack the driver in the other car. Yes. And I saw what had happened. I knew what had happened. And I ran up to them and I said, before there were any blows thrown, look at me.
Yes.
And that was enough to turn them from each other and to stop the moment. The driver with the child in the car had run a red light that he didn't see. And the driver who hit him had a green light, and it was clear. I saw the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And their reactions. And it's understandable when feel like somebody has tried to kill your child.
Oh my God.
And you didn't know that you messed up.
I know.
And all of that is just the emotional wrenching.
Oh yeah.
But we can intervene and break moments like that to have time. Part of me is resistant to focus on these extreme cases which you have brought to us. They are relatively common. I tend to want to avoid the extreme cases to work up to them, but I think we almost all could use some real, I don't know what to say, training in how the use of and response to violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because my stepping into that, had somebody had a gun, but I, you know, it was pretty, my read of the situation, that was not an issue here. But how to read the person you are in the situation you're in, what are your options and how quickly, can you find them? Because you can't think about them.
Right.
It's you have to know them.
That's right. That's
and they will come out of you almost instantaneously.
Oh, I agree.
If you have in a certain sense rehearsed them. So this is not what we've talked about, but particularly in a place like Ithaca, there's a lot of value of intellectual knowing and reasoning. In a crisis, you cannot reason your way anywhere. Yes. It just does not work.
Yes.
And this is neither good nor bad, but it is true of me. One person asked me, what do you think? And my immediate response was, I don't think, I know.
Okay.
Because at a visceral level, and it's a little bit like the autism spectrum, like Temple Grandin, where, you know, she doesn't think through all the connections, they come as pictures, wholly formed. I know in that wholly formed way and can act on it. If I have to stop and think about it, I'm paralyzed, or I'm too slow. I'm not fast enough to be graceful and any help.
Oh, yes.
The joke was that we had a kitchen that where the counters were not level, and I would put an egg on the counter, and if I wasn't careful how I placed it, it would roll off.
Okay.
If I was centered that morning, I would catch it before it hit the floor.
Mm-hmm.
If I was not centered, I wouldn't have the grace to catch it.
Yes.
Okay. That's because I didn't know myself or my situation or how to be in it. And what you're talking about is helping people to cultivate that intuition, that instant reaction, that instant reading, and to trust it.
Yes. And to see it even before it comes.
Right.
You could look at people sometimes and you can see where it's going. You know what I mean? And to do that. Well, do we do that with our children often enough? Have we taught our children enough not to kick somebody into unconsciousness? I mean, that to me is extreme and excessive, more so because it's a child.
Right, right. And what, if you were to have a conversation with your children, I mean, and I was able to do this, not so much when they were really little, but later every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I would ask them, how are you reading me?
Yeah, good.
How do you feel like you have to position yourself because of the mood you see that I'm in?
Yeah.
Or your mother?
Yeah.
Or where we are interacting together? Because children are already doing that kind of reading you just described. We're absolutely all already doing it. That's we're just not taking responsibility for doing the reading and then acting on what we see.
That is exactly it. To use the information.
Right, right. How would you recommend that we learn to use the information?
The only way I could think of doing that is literally by having those kind of conversations about basically, and I'm not, you know, I am not a person who looks at everything as a trauma and looks at everything as a mental health issue.
Right.
Just to have the normal conversation of like, and I'm sorry, and also for me, there's a piece of that you may not do that to people.
Right.
Not a question. You may not treat people like this, and here's why. Here's why you can't. Mm-hmm. Here are the consequences, not only for your life, but for their life when you treat people that way.
Right.
And we have to learn that in life. And to not be irrationally protective. Like someone once said to me, oh no, my child never lies to me and they never treat people poorly. And I'm thinking, how in the world would you know that?
Right.
My kid walks out into the world, I don't know what the hell they're doing half the time. You know what I mean? And we're all human. Right? We all get pissed off and we all, you know, even if you don't do it, there are times when you're like, okay, if I just slap that person, that might help. You know what I mean? Even if you don't do it. Kids have thoughts like that. There are studies that show that kids are far more moral when they're little and then they lose it.
Right.
Because of their interactions in society. So the fact that you can teach them to be moral is real. How do we carry it through enough, not perfectly, enough to at least have them not want to willfully hurt another person? People get into fights. That happens. I get that.
Right. But there is a moral sensibility to a fight that is taken on with a kind of centered moral indignation that a very young child has. It is not an attack. It is not a retaliatory move. It is a response to an injustice in the moment that is physical.
Yes.
And as a parent or an outsider, knowing how to read the difference in those two things is the difference between creating somebody who can stand for justice and somebody who's a monster.
That's exactly right. That's right. And also not, I mean, you don't want to tell children, no, you know, I don't, that they're, well, I have actually, that, you know, you don't want to say like, you know, we are creatures that are aggressive. We are creatures that fight. That's a reality. Everybody knows that there's studies or scientific studies about that. The genetics thing they think are part of it, whatever. So if you know that about yourself as a human being, even as a child, if you said to a child, I know that sometimes you feel like you might want to do this, but this is why you can't. This is why I don't want you to.
Right.
This is why it shouldn't happen. That's what I'm saying. Not to deny. I think that we spend all this time denying that children fight rather than understanding that they fight and people fight and giving them some zone of buffering the emotion and the act. And I don't think we do that at all.
Right, right. So, I mean, so for example, helping to understand it's best if it doesn't come to blows. If it does come to blows, then how did you handle it?
That's
Would you have handled it differently? Would you have not tried to scorch the earth or to completely destroy your opponent, or would you merely pushed back so you had some space to maneuver?
Yes.
You know, yeah.
And you can even ask a child, which I've done. Okay, you got into that fight. How are you feeling right now?
Right.
You feel you're hurt. You physically hurt. You feel bad. You still feel scared. That's not what you were trying to do. I could tell you how to do something else that might not make you feel physically hurt, that might not make you feel that bad, that we can deal with by conversations, as opposed to like, I think that that's the only way to deal with this situation, where the kid comes out of it not feeling any better than they did going into it. Some kids do. That's what I worry about.
Right. But some kids discover that they can use force and it's not a bad thing. And they will feel a little bit jazzed. And then you could, and then you can explore that, because it's not always bad.
It's not always bad if you're. So I used to say to my kid, "You're in a classroom. You're not in the jungle.
Right.
There are people who can help you.
Right.
If you're in a jungle, we'd have a different conversation.
Right. Or if you're out wandering around where there is no.
That was the metaphor. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's it. It's if you are alone. In an unsupervised environment, then you have to become the instrument of your own strength and your own peace.
And God knows you can be in a situation where you actually are threatened. Your life is threatened. Your safety is threatened. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never say to a child, oh, there's never any time to ever fight. I don't say the opposite.
Well, but also in that same time when you're threatened, you may want to be able to discern, is fighting going to help? Is it going to make them worse
if this?
Yeah, and these are but you have to have. You cannot be attached to politeness.
No,
you cannot be attached to violence.
Nope.
And we are in a way attached to both, in an unhealthy way, without looking at the whole array of spaces in between.
That is exactly right, Eric. That is exactly right. You know, and also I've said, look, so I've also said to a child, if you feel like somebody is threatening you, just run away from them. I've even said that.
Right.
Because what I'm trying to do is teach them that there are many ways to deal with those situations. It doesn't always have to come down to blows. And especially to the degree that video showed, or to the degree that, you know, I know my child, to the degree that I know my child can exhibit.
Right. Right, that you have choices.
Yeah.
And you can walk away.
Yep.
You can run away.
Yep.
You can hold your ground without aggression.
That's
exactly. You can use a moderate form of aggression.
That's right.
Or you can scorch the earth.
That's right. That's right. And to connect those other reactions, like walking away,
right,
to connect those, if you have to connect those with, that is your power.
Right.
And that is your power.
Right.
If your power is not always about violence.
Your power is having a choice that feels like the best thing you can do in the moment.
That is exactly right.
And we
don't associate those things. We associate them with being weak or scared or cowardly or whatever. And the world does that too as well. It's not just parents. And we don't say, you know what? To walk away from something is actually a power.
Right. And for many who are like... It's funny. And this is I have a daughter who was extremely fast on the soccer field and good with dribbling the ball, but could not take the kill shot.
Okay.
Because she could not bring her self-perception into that striker method.
Okay.
We need to know that we can strike.
Yeah.
Especially on a playing field.
Yes.
And know that if we had to strike in real life, we could choose to do that or choose not to do that.
Yeah.
Because we know how to play that power.
Yes.
And the other kinds of power that are all around it. But it means that we really do practice, and we reflect on what we've done. We reflect on what worked and what didn't work. and that kid who responds, who hates violence, but is cornered and takes a violent act, sure, need not see themselves as having descended to the level of depravity of the other, but merely having asserted a boundary that was not honored,
yeah,
with anything less. And maybe in the future that assertion could be made in a different way.
That's right. That's exactly right.
But maybe not.
But we have to constantly have those conversations, yeah, with our children. I mean, constantly. If something comes up, if something doesn't come up, if you're watching a TV show, you could stop it and say, hey, look, I could tell you another way that they could have dealt with that situation, but just constantly infusing them with the alternatives to violence.
Right. Right.
Yeah, someone right. mentioned like having a program for children, an alternative to violence program for children, mm-hmm, which I thought was a great idea,
right,
considering what we're watching right now in the world.
Right, right. And especially for younger children.
Yes.
I want them to trust that they can make a variety of different judgments under different circumstances. And I guess anything that thwarts the actions or thoughts of another person is an act of violence. It's a question not of whether or not violence, it's a question of degree and does it accomplish what you,
yeah,
a greater good that was not
happening.
That's
right. That's exactly right.
And I react a little to the alternatives to violence rhetoric, not so much to the practice, but to the rhetoric. What you are asking for, it's implicit in everything you've said, is that we are not spectators in our lives or the lives of our children. Neither, on the flip side, are we the directors of our fate. We're neither in that much control or in that little control. So it means that we are at all times navigating or negotiating or figuring out what impact can I have? Or do I have to let this one go?
That's right, exactly.
And if I don't process to some extent every conflict that rattles my guts, that conflict is going to bleed out someplace else.
Oh yeah.
That's or some kind of a conflict in my head or heart. That's and any right. if there is, it's going to come out someplace else.
Yes.
And if we're really on top of ourselves, we're going to see it where it happens. But most of us don't see it that early. We right. see it through an overreaction or through a reaction that seems to come out of the blue.
That's right. I mean, there are ways, you know, the same way I was growing up, that we help children to be able to read situations, like I think you mentioned before, to read body language, to
sure.
read facial expressions, to read right. context even, that says, you know, it's the same way of saying, oh no, don't go down that alley, because people are usually mugged in that alley. It's mm-hmm. the same kind of thing. Like, let's read the situation. And sometimes you can see that the only thing that's going to come out of that situation is violence. And right. so let's not go into that if it's not warranted.
Right, right. And you're bringing, in another group, we had a conversation that was inspired by something you sent. I want to take a break from music and then we'll come to this example. And okay. that's what we'll close the show with, I think. And I can find something if I need to, or if you've got something, let's go.
Well, you know, there's a song, I'm not sure, it's called Father and Daughter by, it's actually Paul Simon.
Yes.
Okay, good. That's a nice song.
You leap awake in the mirror of a bad dream.
This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm Peaches Gillette, sitting here with Eric Clay. We're doing a program called Facing Our Lives. And we're talking about violence in children, how to possibly get ahead of it and stop it, and to teach them ways of reading situations where they don't have to feel, and reading their own emotions where they don't have to step into it. We would love to hear your input. You can get in touch with us by calling 607-319-5445, extension 6. Or by sending an email to info@nativeclay.org.
So one of the initiating events of this conversation today was a video Peaches that you sent out of an autistic teenage, black teenage boy who was attacked on the subway by a group of girls. I think Latino or white. I couldn't tell for sure. And it was savage. It was brutal. It was filmed by bystanders. Yeah. And what was striking is that not only did no one intervene in the train or off the train when the attack was happening, nobody comforted the boy. And he ended up going on his way without any attention. So when we talked about the incident, and in this other setting, what we began to do was to think through who we each were by our age, by our body type, by our temperament. And almost each one of us could have responded, but we would have responded in a very different way.
Yeah.
And that's not often really discussed. So no. the oldest, and in some say slightest of the group, said if he felt he could raise his voice without becoming then the object of attack, that's one thing that he could do. I suggested that many people in that situation wait until the violence is over and they give comfort and aid to those who have been hurt. That is a perfectly legitimate response when you cannot step into something that you cannot imagine how to do it. Others felt, you know, differently, that they could have just created a scene and screamed, or that they could have, you know, they're just other responses. And I'm wondering, this was the video that caught your interest on challenging, how are we raising children that this happens? How do you want to take this?
You know, if it were, there are a lot of things that shock my system. If it were one child fighting a child, even if the child was autistic, you know, I might have a very different perspective, maybe. The fact that a group of children were doing this, and a group of people are videotaping it. First of all, they're children. So, you know, if it were me, I'd probably stop them because they were children. If it were two men, I don't think I'd step in. You know, but these
were early teenage.
They were girls. Early teens, but I don't know if there were any other people on the train besides those kids.
Right, and the people filming. Oh yes, there were, in terms of the videos,
right.
We got them. But then the people filming, I'm not sure, they were not kids; they were bystanders.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that I remember an incident where a woman, I don't know if she was drunk or on drugs, she's wrangling her child around. He was probably about 8 years old, and threatening to throw him off the train. This was years ago. And the train's full. I'm there. Peter's there. Train's full. And I'm listening and listening, and it keeps elevating the language that she's using and the threatening. And then she takes the child by his scuff of his neck, and she drags him in between the cars. And I immediately ran out between the cars and said, "You can't do that. You cannot do that."
Right.
And I grabbed the child and I threw him back inside the cars, and she attacked me and broke my glasses and ripped my shirt and was attacking me. But in my head, I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to sit here and let this happen.
Right.
And I'll sacrifice what I need to sacrifice to do that.
Right. That's right.
And that's what I'm hoping, that I understand if somebody has a gun or whatever, I get it. But I hope that people could step more into that role. And try to help somebody before they get pummeled.
Right.
And then continue on to comfort that person.
Right, right.
And not look at the people who perpetrated. This is what I hate in this society. The people who did that, they look at them as, well, you know, they probably need help. They probably have mental health issues. That's not where my sympathy goes.
Right, right.
Because there are people with mental health issues all over this planet who don't do that.
Right, right.
And it's a culture that creates that. And nobody takes responsibility. That's what the problem is. No one collectively takes responsibility for it. That's what bothers me more than anything. Like, yeah. People are blaming, you know, teachers blame it on the family, the family's blaming it on school, and, you know, who's blaming it on this person. But collectively, we're all responsible for that in many different ways. It was funny, I read this law. California one time tried to stop violent video games that had mature content labeled on them from being sold to minors, and it was shot down by the Supreme Court. Unbelievable. Why? Even the company who made it labeled it mature content.
Right.
I mean, right. Maybe you look at maturity a different way than I do. But I'm just saying that we all are invested in this violence, whether it's because of money that we're making from it, by being silent about it, by rationalizing it, by making the attacker the victim, as opposed to the person who's attacked. People do that all the time.
Right.
In these issues too. If I complain about somebody being a racist, I actually did in a job I had when I first came up here, complain about somebody saying something without a question that was racist. And they were trying to make me feel bad about the fact that that person felt bad about saying that. And I should feel guilty about even mentioning it to them because it made them feel really bad. This is what we do.
Right.
And this is what we do in our psychology, and this is what we do constantly. And what it does is it lets people off the hook in terms of being accountable or taking responsibility for what they did that was awful.
Right. I want to go back.
This is not about forgiveness.
No.
That's a whole different ball of wax.
This is about acknowledgement and accountability and remorse and guilt and shame.
Yes.
And all of those things need to be fully functioning chords in our emotional.
Thank you for somebody saying that. Absolutely, without a question. When we've extracted those things from the culture and from the society, what else is going to be the outcome?
I want to go back to your example of the child and his caregiver or mother or who. When you pulled the child back into the train and she attacked you, did anybody... Pardon?
I didn't touch her.
But she attacked you. When were there any other bystander responses in that situation? What happened?
Someone in the train grabbed the child. Mm-hmm. That was great. They took him, when I put him back in the train car, they took him at least to keep him somewhere in their arms are safe. That mm-hmm. was great. By the time we got to the next station, somebody obviously called the police because there were like 20 police officers rushing into the train by the time we got to the station.
Sure.
And I told them what had happened. And I'm saying this for a reason. I never lifted a hand to hurt her.
Sure.
Never did.
Right. You didn't defend yourself as you intervened with her child.
That wasn't the goal.
Right. No, it wasn't about you.
That's right.
Right. And you can intervene physically and violently in an event. And if you don't defend yourself, you don't become a combatant.
That's right.
You know, and you can take the blows in a way, or take the tearing of your clothing or the breaking of your glasses in a way that allows that to be the dissolution of the energy.
Yes.
That the perpetrator had to begin with.
That's exactly the mother, right.
Rather than escalate it by
That's
coming
right.
back at it. But That's that right. requires knowing how to fight.
Yes.
You know, because you did fight, but you did not strike back.
That's exactly right. Because the story becomes, in her mind, obviously this enraged parent, the story would become in her mind, I was fighting to defend myself against this woman who was hurting me.
Right.
That's what the story ends up being.
Right.
And I didn't create that story for her.
Right. And the child who was taken by another person, was that child comfortable? Do you have the presence of mind to know if that child was comfortable in that person's hold?
I think so. I think that child was so afraid that anything
would have been better.
The comfort and the relief.
Right.
That child's face, I don't even want to think about it. It was just absolutely horrible situation.
Sure.
And of course, I turned around to my husband and said, I told you we shouldn't go out on New Year's Eve. Like, you know, because I thought, and we would have never had this situation. So, but I'm really, I will never forget that, because it was just like, you can't do that.
Right. And yet your honesty, if you had not been out on New Year's Eve, there might be a dead kid on the track.
Exactly. It's so true. It's like a catch-22, right?
Yeah. And And this is this gets me in trouble with people in my household. We're not guaranteed a happy time.
None of us.
Yeah. And we have to make the world we want to live in.
That's exactly right.
And we have to realize that some people are willing to tolerate what we cannot stand. And that sometimes people will not tolerate what we think is essential.
Yeah.
You know, and they're going to block us. And that's part of the process.
Yes. And this idea that we teach our children in many ways without saying it, that life is supposed to be perfectly comfortable for you. People are supposed to entertain you and make you happy all the time. And no one's allowed to push back against what you want. And not only do I see that in children, I see that in adults.
Right.
Cannot handle these things at all. These things are simple coping skills to me.
Right. And what I feel compelled to say is that the people who cared about raising children where I grew up, and there were many people who didn't, but those who really did care, they wanted to see what each child was made of. And so when would they react in a violent way? When would they use measured force? When would they use words? When would they realize that words are not helpful here and other forms of gestures would be appropriate? And, you know, when too often when the term to see what you're made of is meant to be like a test where you have to cross the bar,
right.
but it's not.
No,
it's about knowing exactly where your strengths and weaknesses lie and how you can use them to advantage in whatever circumstance you find yourself.
That is exactly right.
But we don't think about our formation of our children or our ongoing formation of ourselves.
That's right.
In those terms.
That's right.
Okay. There are some fights that are good to get in. I guess this is what was it? John Lewis said, there's sometimes it's important to make good trouble. You know, and there are some times when a peaceful gesture is critical.
Yeah.
Even if it's not exactly truthful.
That's right. That's right.
So as we wind down, you've brought all the music today, and I actually didn't have time to come up with any. Do you have something you'd like to close with?
I think I do. Let me check. There's a song, Motherless Child. I don't remember. Oh my God, I love that song.
Yep. Peaches, good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Thank you very much.
And this has been the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. We have been considering the challenges of violence and how to raise children and be with them and be with each other in a way that gives us more options so that we can face the conflicts in ways that deal with them in the least violent, most peaceful way possible.
Absolutely.
That we may come out of it more whole than we went into it.
Thank you. And I'll talk to you soon.
Yes. Bye-bye. Guitar of Mike Free.
more.